If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. And before I introduce our guest today, I just want to thank everybody who has signed up on the website and is following us and subscribed. At this point in the podcast, we're trying to build our viewership and our listenership. So if you can help us out by rating us online or wherever you download the podcast, and make sure you sign up or subscribe and go to the website and make sure you're signed up for updates. All right. This week we have a guest I've been looking forward to for a while. Tom Chisdock is a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent. He spent most of his career working in the southeastern U.S., but he got his start when he was a new agent working in the Los Angeles field office. So Tom and I share the same training officer. We were both trained by Marie Palladini, who's been on the show before. Tom retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2019, and he shortly thereafter received the Guy Bradley Award for Outstanding Career Service, which is a real accomplishment. The award's named after the first conservation law enforcement officer killed in the line of duty. And he definitely had a stellar career. I've always admired the work that he did, and I'm really happy to welcome him on the show. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Ed. I appreciate it.
I think we're going to have a fun conversation today, but I just wanted to point out that because you had worked you left LA just before I arrived. So how long were you working in Los Angeles?
I worked in Los Angeles for just over 2 years, and I transferred to Washington State after that.
Gotcha. Yep. And I think I came in right after that because there were lots of Tom Chisdock stories around the office when I arrived.
None of them good.
All good. And because you had been in the off-field office where I eventually worked, I, of course, know some agents who worked with you. And I, before I came to the podcast recording today, I called him and I asked him for some comments about Tom Chisdock or some thoughts. And here's some words that came up: integrity, hard worker, creative undercover work. But this is the one that really struck me, and that was always ate leftovers for lunch.
That's true. I'm a frugal guy.
What's that about? Yeah, you know, actually, I know exactly what that's about. And that was, you were a new agent working in Los Angeles, which is one of the most expensive duty stations to live in.
So that's true.
That's what leftovers is all about. the other thing we have in common, when you and I were talking as to prep for this, you and I both really wanted to be special agents for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I was struck when you told me that you had applied for the job 5 times. And that's exactly how many times it took me to get hired as well. Yeah. And, you know, I think I really click with people who really wanted the job, because I think, like you, before I became a special agent for Fish and Wildlife Service, I always looked at the agents and I thought, man, these are some really good agents. I mean, everything I ever read about their cases, I just thought, these are unbelievably good investigators, extremely tenacious, and I wanted to be part of that group. I think you felt the same, didn't you?
Exactly. You know, I read an article, I don't know if it was from the Federal Wildlife Officers Association or National Geographic or something, but it was an operation that occurred outside Yellowstone National Park, Operation Trophy Kill. And at the time, I was a ranger with the Park Service. And I read that article, and it just really hit me and struck me. And I was like, that's what I want to do.
I know exactly the article you're talking about. And I think it was Nat Geo. And it was the agents were working on outfitters or hunters that were basically either sneaking into Yellowstone National Park or they were luring big elk out of the park, right? I can't remember, maybe both.
Yeah. A lot of big game, yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that too, and it was one of many stories around that time, late 90s, late 90s, I guess, that really influenced me and made me think, I got to be part of this organization, right?
Exactly.
eventually, after LA, you went to Washington State, but you eventually made your way to the southeastern U.S., where you spent a large part of your career, and you really made a name for yourself working on cases involving ginseng. And I am guessing some of my listeners will know what ginseng is, but some might not. So can you explain to us a little bit about what ginseng is and why it's of interest to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement?
Well, maybe like some of your listeners, that when I transferred to North Carolina, I didn't know anything about ginseng either. Trying to talk to sister agencies and particularly the Park Service, I quickly learned that there was quite the commercial trade in wild American ginseng. Ginseng is a deciduous type plant that grows all along the Appalachian Mountains. It'll even grow down as far south as northern Mississippi and all the way up to southern Canada. And it's a plant that grows in shady areas. It's like I said, deciduous, so it comes up in the spring, and then it grows, forms berries to reproduce, and then in the fall, October, November, the leaves start to turn colors, and the foliage dies, and it goes back down, and you can't see it after that until the spring when it pops back up, so a perennial plant. Traditionally, people have harvested ginseng and dug it and sold it for commercial purposes. They use it for medicinal purposes. Back when I first started, about 90-95% of the wild American ginseng was being exported out of this country. And so that's how the Fish and Wildlife Service is involved with that. It's regulated under CITES, Convention International Trade Endangered Species, and that's overlaid on some state regulations. You're required to have a dealer's license to buy and sell it. There's permits that are required to move it in interstate commerce. So it's a commodity, but also it's a resource for a lot of mountain folks. You know, traditionally they dug it, you know, they saved it till November to sell it to a dealer, might have used it for Christmas money or something like that. So it's really ingrained in the Southern Appalachian Mountains and the people of the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And like I said, there's a legal season that starts generally in September and goes through until the plant dies back, and then the seasons close in the spring and summertime to give the plant an opportunity to grow and produce berries to reproduce.
You told me something interesting about ginseng that I didn't know. I didn't know about the whole berry thing, but associated with the legal trade where somebody has a permit and they're doing everything legally where they can collect it and potentially sell it. With regard to those berries, there's something very specific that a legal collector has to do. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so the seasons generally begin about September 1, and that allows the fruit to grow on the plant and literally to grow to fruition. And then when you harvest the ginseng, there's berries on the plant, you're required to plant the berries at the site to propagate, you know, that species for perpetuity.
That is so interesting that it's kind of built into the legal framework of the collection process. You actually have to become a propagator as well as part of the legal process. What's the market? You mentioned that some ginseng goes overseas, or a lot of it. What's the market overseas for ginseng?
It's basically for traditional Chinese medicine, you know, Eastern medicine, you know, a little different than the medicine that we're, used to in the Western culture. But it's highly sought after, like other types of commodities, you know, that we've dealt with over our careers, you know, whether that's bear bile, bear gall bladder, pangolin, you know, all different types of natural resources, whether they're plants or animals used for medicinal purposes.
Right, right. And then I assume because it's listed as CITES, and our agency was called U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It had wildlife in it. There's no plant named in the name of our agency. Most state agencies do not have plants in their name. But you know, many, many species listed under the Endangered Species Act in the United States are plants, and many, many species listed under CITES are plants. And so the agents of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are responsible for enforcing those laws. So we often do get involved in plant trafficking or plant illegal plant collection cases. Can you describe the illegal trade a little bit in ginseng? What's the illegal trade? Who's involved and where's it going?
Yeah, like, you know, any item, resource that's commercialized, you know, you generally have the legal trade, and then there's what, you know, we often refer to as a black market trade. And so with regards to ginseng, there are dealers who do not want to go through the proper channels to purchase a permit or a license to deal in ginseng. It costs money to do that. There's some paperwork that's involved when a digger comes in to sell ginseng. They've got to write down the person's name, what county it was dug in, how much they sold. And that's just to keep biological tabs on the ginseng population, you know, to keep it safe from extinction or overexploitation. But there are some dealers who will operate without a license because of that. And there are also a lot of dealers or even diggers that will harvest and purchase and sell ginseng prior to the season opening in September. So when the first comes up in, you know, early April or May, oftentimes there are some people who are out there taking advantage of the system. They're harvesting the ginseng at that time and, you know, selling it or holding it till the legal season opens. So what's the big deal, right? Well, the big deal is that those plants don't grow to fruition to produce their seeds. So there's no seeds to, you know, plant at the site to help perpetuate the species. And, you know, also it's just an unfair advantage to legal dealers who are doing everything right. And then you might have somebody who's up in a holler or somewhere and just trying to beat the system. They buy, you know, ginseng without a license, and then they sell quantities to people who have a license. So they're taken away from the legal dealers who are actually following the legal system.
And then I assume it's illegal to collect, period, inside a national park, right?
Yes, national park, it's illegal to collect. The U.S. Forest Service, a vast majority of Western North Carolina and East Tennessee is also Forest Service lands. And there used to be a lawful season where you could go in and dig ginseng. And then the population has started to decline. And so then there was a permit system where you had to get a permit system to dig it. And you were allowed to dig one wet pound or green ginseng that weighed a pound. And then things even got worse. So they started to have a lottery, and you'd have to apply in a lottery to get a permit to dig ginseng. They've only allowed for so many on Forest Service property. And then the population continued to dwindle, where now, and I think until this day, the harvest of wild American ginseng on Forest Service lands is still closed in Western North Carolina.
Wow. Okay. So population of wild ginseng declined, and then that makes poaching and trafficking in it even more critical to address, right?
Right. You mentioned closing a national park, and there is a national park that, you know, straddles both Tennessee and North Carolina, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And so where's the best place to dig ginseng? Where it's always closed. So the national park has a lot of ginseng.
Exactly. And that's true with a lot of species that are illegally poached or taken, both plant and animal. Often the targeted areas are the areas where it's closed, right? Because,
correct.
Yeah, that's you don't have to compete with anybody else, or at least you don't have to compete with any other legal collectors out there. All you have to do is compete with law enforcement officers. how many, over your career, how many ginseng cases do you think you worked?
Just cases, a handful.
Okay.
But in those cases were multi-defendants, you know, 20, 30 defendants. So, I ran personally three undercover investigations that were multiple years. So over that time, there's a lot of different dealers and diggers involved in that.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about one of those cases in particular. I think it was a guy you investigated named Johnny Grooms, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. How did Johnny Grooms come to your attention, and how did you get involved in a criminal investigation related to him and ginseng?
Well, Johnny Grooms, he came on the radar several times, but this case involved Special Agent Ryan Knoll on the Knoxville, Tennessee office, where he received a call from the TWAR, the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, which is Tennessee State Wildlife Agency, from a wildlife officer, substantiating that Johnny Grooms was buying ginseng illegally without a license from the park entrance store, grocery store, right outside of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And so Ryan started to look into it. And then about a month later, he got another phone call from a district ranger from the Great Smoky Mountains National Park telling Ryan that, hey, we believe there are people going into the park, harvesting ginseng and selling it to Johnny Grooms. So Ryan, knowing that I had been involved with several ginseng cases, Ryan was new to that duty station. He called me up and asked me if I knew Johnny Grooms. And I said, oh, most definitely I know Johnny Grooms. So about 3 years later, when I was running one of the undercover investigations, Johnny called me. I was a licensed dealer in undercover capacity. And it's not unusual for dealers or diggers to call licensed dealers and chat them up and, you know, right, what's the current price? What do you think the season's going to be like? So that's how I first had my introduction to Johnny. So we talked about prices and, you know, where I thought the market was going. And, you know, he said, you know, stay in touch, come by, introduce yourself. So I went over and talked to Johnny and, you know, introduced myself. He had showed me some ginseng that he had. He told me he had several pounds there. But at the time, he didn't want to sell it. Johnny, as an individual, I don't know if he just was burned out or he had a lot of stress in his life. He talked about kind of marbles in his mouth. He was a very hard guy to understand. But through all this and talking briefly with Johnny, you know, the spidey sense came up that there's a lot going on at this place. And Johnny sort of gave me the runaround. He wanted a lot of money for his ginseng, which wasn't market value, and I wasn't willing to pay it for above market value. So I basically just walked away. Okay. So that was my first association with Johnny.
And that was that was like 3 years before Ryan called you?
Correct.
Gotcha.
And so Ryan asked me if I could go over and chat him up and, you know, just talk to him and do a reintroduction and maybe build some rapport. So I went and talked with Johnny, met with him, and again, I said he was kind of an aloof person, but also scatterbrained. And, you know, I said, hey, you know, this, so I am, you know, I was wondering if you had any ginseng to sell. And he misunderstood me and thought I was trying to sell ginseng. I was like, no, I'm a dealer. And then it kind of clicked to him and it was like, oh, yeah, we met before. And so it was instant rapport with Johnny. And again, we went through the same thing, talking about prices and, you know, what he thought the market was going to be. And so by this time, it was later in the year after Ryan had kind of started looking into it. And we just kind of talked a little bit. And so Ryan kind of started moving forward on going through the process of about starting an undercover investigation. And as you know, there's a lot of paperwork to jump to. And,
yeah.
You know, what Ryan did the heavy lifting on that, you know, I got to do the fun part. But so Ryan, you know, eventually got everything going. And so we were kind of sort of off to the races at that point.
Gotcha. You know, you mentioned that Johnny kind of, he spoke with a heavy Southern accent, I assume, right? And then on top of that, maybe had some way of speaking that made it even more difficult to understand him.
Yeah, he certainly did. You know, obviously, I didn't grow up in the South. I don't, you know, have a Southern accent. Johnny had a really harsh East Tennessee accent. And so it was often hard to understand what he was saying. But, you know, I'd been around a lot of folks during my ginseng investigations. And, you know, I started to understand him pretty good. And, but a point that comes up is, you know, when you're cutting audio tapes and you're having to transcribe audio tapes for the U.S. Attorney's Office and prosecution, it was a nightmare for folks to try to work on those tapes to transcribe them.
I'll bet. I have two questions related to this. One is, first of all, can you kind of just tell us what Johnny looked like?
Johnny was very thin. He obviously, you know, was white, you know, had a mustache. I'm assuming he used drugs. I never saw him use drugs, but kind of sort of, if you want to think of a stereotypical alcoholic person, you know, very thin and emaciated.
Yeah.
And that was kind of his. Yeah.
Gotcha. And then you also mentioned that once Agent Ryan Knowles kind of asked you to do the undercover work on this case, you already had prior contact with Johnny Grooms. And so you just kind of went into this store. And this is like one of those stores that's right outside the national park where tourists can stop and get drinks and chips and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The park entrance grocery store is right outside the boundary of Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Cosby, Tennessee, which is in Cock County. Cock County is a somewhat of a notorious county. There have been several federal investigations there with, regarding chop shops of cars, prostitution, state political corruption. There was a big investigation there right kind of when Ryan's investigation was beginning that had culminated Operation Rose Thorn. And that investigation had to deal with some corrupt police officers in the local town and county sheriffs that were involved in some activities with regards to distribution of cocaine and money laundering. And the FBI also in this investigation took down a big cockfighting arena. There was approximately 200 people that were charged in that with for gambling and cockfighting. So it's an interesting place, but it's also a beautiful place. You know, lots of fishing there, lots of whitewater rafting. It's of course like on the doorstep of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. But you talked about the store, the park entrance grocery store. You know, you could buy a bag of chips there or soda, but there wasn't much else in there, like some old camping gear. And it was certainly what we would classify a storefront for a drug operation. And right. That was found out pretty quickly.
It was a front. Interesting. So, you know, given that county's history, you mentioned, police and corruption involved there. That's like kind of your worst nightmare to be working in a county where you're an undercover, you know, law enforcement officer and the local law enforcement may not be trustworthy, right? That's kind of a scary situation.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that's tough. So given that you are not a Southerner, you've got, you know, you were not born and raised in that area and the county has already kind of had this massive, you know, influx of federal law enforcement there for other investigations. Why do you think you were able to build rapport with Johnny Grooms so quickly? Was he like really naive or was he a paranoid kind of guy?
He was both actually. But he trusted me. He was very paranoid. The park entrance grocery store, when you walked in the store, Johnny had a bank of about 4 televisions that were on and they were all on in different channels. And the volume was turned up loud. There was an old, if you could picture a creaky ceiling fan going, you know, in the store. And it was very loud in there. And I don't know if he did that specifically to deter, you know, people coming in there who was going to try to record him doing illegal activities. But also, he was trustworthy to me because throughout my friendship with him, I never screwed him.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, on a couple of buys that I did with Johnny, he brought more ginseng, or the people he sent me to sell me the ginseng brought more ginseng than I was anticipating. So I only had so much cash on him. So I'd have to, you know, say, hey, John, I owe you a couple $1,000. And he was fine with that. The next time we met, I gave him the money, you know, we always settled up. So he really trusted me. And whatever, you know, we agreed on doing, you know, I always did it.
Gotcha. So you were probably the most trustworthy or the most reliable person he dealt with in what he was doing, right?
That's correct.
So once you got into it, you reestablished this relationship with him again. Like, what did you discover he was up to?
Well, that first time that I went in September, which the ginseng season opens then. And so it's a good time to go in and talk about ginseng. You know, we're talking about prices and dealers and markets, you know, what's going on. And he shows me a half a pound of dried ginseng. He just immediately starts talking about, you know, illegal activities. I mean, that first meeting with him was very productive. And I don't think Ryan's undercover investigation was even open at that time. I mean, he mentioned that he knew diggers were going in the park. He told me he was selling green or fresh undried ginseng to a Korean individual. I'd asked him at that time, are you going to fool with a license this year? And he's like, no, I don't even know how much they cost. And while I'm in the store, a gentleman approaches the counter. And so obviously I could sense that he wants to talk to Johnny. So I step away from the counter and I could hear him talking to Johnny. Johnny pulls out a pill bottle and puts a pill on the countertop. The person hands Johnny some cash, puts the pill in his pocket. So I could hear him talking about hydros, which I'm assuming at the time is hydrocodone, which is an opioid. And so, you know, I'm getting all this, you know, great information from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, right, on the first introduction or reintroduction with Johnny. He also tells me about a digger that he had recently met from Kentucky who just came out of the park with a sack of ginseng. And, you know, I'm talking and I say, yeah, I heard that they marked the ginseng in the park. And he's like, yeah, they put these little pieces of wire in there and they have a scanner and they could scan it and tell if the ginseng came from the park. And they also dyed this ginseng. And so his, you know, culpability already at this point and, you know, substantiation for the Fish and Wildlife Service at that point, it was just phenomenal.
Yeah. You have no worries about entrapping him here at all, right?
None at all.
None at all. None at all. And, you know, what year is this? What year are we talking about?
2008.
So, yeah, opiate crisis is kind of just, it's going hard right then, right? In that region of the country.
Yeah. You know, in the mid 2000s, you know, the country was facing this opioid crisis and high drug overdoses and particularly in the rural Appalachian states, you know, and it was deeply affecting, you know, folks, that drug epidemic at the time.
So now you've got information that he's potentially involved in trafficking opioids as well. I mean, at some point, you learned that some other agencies were interested in grooms too, right? Didn't you?
Exactly. So Ryan, you know, Ryan's doing the heavy lifting. He's, you know, jumping through the hoops with our agency and then, you know, to get everything approved. You know, we have certain parameters that we have to follow, which, you know, are all good things. And so Ryan contacts the U.S. Attorney's Office in Knoxville there to get support for the investigation to prosecute any defendants that come up like we, you know, we always do.
Right.
And so the U.S. Attorney's Office says, well, the FBI and the DEA and the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, actually have their eye on Johnny and they suspect he's involved with a prostitution ring and a drug ring. And so we would certainly like to join forces and work with you guys. So that was a big help to the investigation to know that somebody could do the heavy lifting on the drug side of things.
You bet. And I'll bet you anything that the FBI and the DEA and the TBI were pretty damn excited when they heard that there was already a UC special agent infiltrating Johnny Grooms. I mean, that's like a great scenario for them.
Oh, they were. And, you know, I'm obviously working selfishly the ginseng angle, you know, I'm trying to see the big picture.
Right.
And, you know, so Johnny and I are still talking on the phone all the time. What's the prices? I have not bought any ginseng from him. You know, it's September, the season's open. I'm trying to go slow, you know, and build rapport with Johnny. And I sense the DEA is getting a little antsy, you know, like, let's get this thing rolling on the drug side, you know. So
right.
I hop in my truck and I, you know, go over to give Johnny another visit. And again, we just start where we left off. He's asking me if I know anyone who sells pills. You know, we start chatting about marijuana, you know, eventually goes to cocaine. And you're talking about paranoia before that. He's telling me, you're like, hey, we talk on the phone. Be very concerned about what you're saying to me. I think the police are monitoring my phone. If you want to talk about drugs, we should use code words. So if you know, I'm not asking to buy anything yet.
Right.
But, you know, I'm telling Johnny that, you know, basically I'm all about money, making money, whichever way we can. You help me, I'll help you. And, you know, it's all good with me. So he tells me, well, if you want cocaine, you know, just call it a, instead of calling it a rock, say, want a big ginseng root, and I'll know what you're talking about. And he even goes on to talk about what types of vehicles, the TBI and the DEA drive, and, you know, look out for them. If we're going to meet, we're going to meet, you know, on a bridge. Don't come on the weekends because the police are always around the weekend. He was very astute to what the local happenings were there, what was going on. I had mentioned earlier about that investigation, Operation Rose Thorn, that had culminated right at the time Ryan's investigation was starting. In the store there at the Park Entrance Grocery Store, Johnny had a plaque that read, "I survived Operation Rose Thorn."
I wonder if he had that made or if somebody gave it to him.
I don't know if it was the badge of honor or what, but he was definitely paranoid. He showed me an RF detector that he had in the store in case anybody came in and was running a radio frequency to, you know, record or body wire. And I'm not sure if it worked, but it certainly, you know, got my hackles up when I was, you know, going in there to chat him up and talk with him.
You bet. That would be something to be very concerned about if you were an undercover, you know, law enforcement officer going in and somebody is that paranoid and they're actually taking, you know, positive steps to counteract surveillance equipment. That you definitely would not want that RF detector to go off when you walked in the door, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, back to me mentioning that the DEA might have been getting a little antsy. So, you know, they're all ready for the Fish and Wildlife and me specifically to, you know, try to buy drugs from Johnny. And I'm all for, you know, working with other agencies.
You bet.
And so, you know, they want me to go in next and buy some cocaine. And again, I'm agreeable to that. But I want to be cross-designated authority,
you know,
with the DEA. Because as you know, our authority as special agents of the Fish and Wildlife is pretty specific to fish, wildlife, plants. We enforce, you know, Title 16, 18, the drug Title 21. It's not something that we did.
Right.
So I always wanted to make sure that, you know, liability wise, that was covered. You know, if something went bad, you know, somebody shot me or I shot them, I didn't want to be hung out to dry. So,
right.
You know, they understood that. And so they said, okay, we'll run it up the chain. You know, they come back, okay, you're good to go. You could, you know, go in there and try to buy some drugs. And I'm like, yeah, but I want, you know, the piece of paper with the official cross designation authority that says, you know,
yes,
Tom and Ryan could do these things. And, you know, we're in a joint operation with the DEA. And
right.
So, you know, they're like, okay. And then I think basically what happens is our SAC, our special agent in charge, you know, contacts the special agent in charge for the DEA and they work it out. And then it took a while. So you know, we're talking about September and then November I met him. It took about to January for Ryan and I to get that cross designation authority. And, you know, I was being a stickler about it and I knew that they weren't too excited because their case was rolling and obviously they wanted to get going, but I was in the timeout mode. Like, look, I've got to have this piece of paper. And, you know, eventually we worked it out.
Yeah. And I don't blame you for doing that. And it's kind of interesting. I think it'll be interesting to non-law enforcement listeners of the podcast that, you know, what's portrayed on TV about the conflict between different agencies and, you know, how the FBI is often portrayed as walking in and taking over cases, that actually doesn't really happen very often in real life. Most of the time, agencies work very fluidly together, very cooperatively, but there are sometimes these weird bureaucratic things where, like you said, you wanted to be cross-designated, which basically just means that the DEA is kind of deputizing you to that you have authority to enforce their primary statutes. And like you said, from your perspective, you're the guy going in there has got to meet with this bad guy who now is into ginseng, opioids, cocaine, marijuana. Likely, you know, when that kind of money's involved, people will kill you for that kind of stuff. And if something really went bad, you want to make sure that it's in writing, in a file, that everybody knew that Tom Chizdok was working under the authority of the DEA and the FBI, for sure. So on this, you know, we're getting away from ginseng a little bit, but I think it's really interesting. How did he orchestrate getting his opioids? Because you were telling me about that, and I found that really interesting, his roots and his method for getting his hands on opioids.
Yeah, we certainly got away from ginseng, but you know, we eventually circled back around, you know, after a while there. But so what Johnny was doing is he would encourage people to go down to what were referred to at the time as pill mills in Florida. So a lot of people were going down to Florida at the time, and they would go to certain areas that were having portable MRI stations set up. So you could go get MRI and show that there was something wrong with you. And then you could just go into any drugstore down there with your prescription that they would give you. And they would give you, you know, 150, 200, you know, hydros or roxys, you know, even OxyContin. And that was it. You know, we know about, you know, what's kind of happened to some of the big pharma because of that, you know.
Right.
But so he would just encourage people to go down and do that. And they would get a script of an opioid, and they would bring it back and sell some of those pills to Johnny. And so Johnny was selling them for about $1 a gram. So if there was a 30 gram hydro, you know, we 30 bucks. It was 40 grams. It was $40. And as things moved on and the DEA, you know, did a lot more background work, he, by the end of this, he was actually paying people to fly down to Florida.
Wow.
You know, there was a legionnaire that would fly out of East Tennessee down to Florida. You know, he'd buy them a hotel. You know, they would go get their MRI. They would get their prescriptions, and they would start to get the prescription filled at different areas. In fact, one time he told me that he was talking to a pharmacist in Tennessee. If people could bring prescriptions back from Florida and have them filled in Tennessee, because what was happening is he would front people money to do this, and they would be, you know, eating the pills, they would be stealing his money. And that kind of gets back to the trust for me. Like, I never ripped him off.
Right.
So he specifically told me about this pharmacist that he talked to and said, you know, could they bring him back and bring him in the store and get the prescriptions filled? And the pharmacist says, yeah, I don't think so, that, you know, you should be doing that. You know, you could get, the pharmacist could get in trouble. And Johnny's comment was like, well, look, they'll have to arrest every damn pharmacist in Florida, because you just get your prescription, walk in and get it filled. Wow. And he wasn't exaggerating. I mean, that was going on for a number of years till the DEA stepped in and like shut all that down with these mobile MRIs and, you know, a quick prescription, and then, you know, you fill them and that was it.
Crazy. And, you know, because you were trustworthy, did he ever try to recruit you to go down and be a mule to bring opioids back?
Oh, he did. And in fact, he, one time when I was in the store, he pulled out a notebook and he drew the schematic for me on how this works. Like, I couldn't figure out how to get from the airport to get a hotel, you know. He drew it all out on a piece of paper, and he would tell me, okay, you need to buy this plane ticket. This is how much this costs. You know, you get a hotel room down there, this is how much this costs. You know, you go, you get your MRI, they're going to charge you a little bit, and then you get the prescription, and I'll buy all the pills that you bring back.
Wow.
He actually literally mapped it out on a notebook piece of paper to show me how to do that.
Wow. And, you know, on this regard, were you ever asked to do drugs with him or anything like that?
Never.
Okay.
And I never portrayed myself as a user.
Right.
What I had told Johnny is that I had a friend in North Carolina who did sell drugs, and you know, he was always looking for new sources to purchase drugs from. And so I, you know, circled back to the, you know, I'm just here to make Johnny money, Johnny, any way I can.
Right.
I'm not interested in doing drugs. You know, the closest that it came is when I did buy an ounce of cocaine from Johnny. And he put it up to his nose and smelled it, and he put it up to my nose, you know. And, you know, and somebody much more popular than me, I didn't inhale, you know.
Yeah. Just, right.
I just kind of gave it the old, oh, yeah, okay, that's good. And I had no idea.
Right.
And one of the things that he did do is he would bring out a variety of pills, and he would put them on the counter when I was there. And he would say, this is a hydro. This is 30 milligrams. This is OxyContin. you know, this is a Roxy. And he would show me these pills and tell me all about them while I was there. And
wow.
Why he did that, I don't know. But, you know, he wanted to buy pills from me. You know, he was into making money. And like I said, quite frankly, he just trusted me.
Yeah. I mean, I think I bet that's why he was doing it, because he was just had his fingers crossed that here's a guy I can rely on. He wanted to recruit you into, you know, his pill mill situation because he couldn't trust his other mules. I'm sure that's what it was.
Oh, and just the people who were buying, you know, from him, like a pill at a time. You know, after we got the authority to work cross designation, I was in the store, and a woman buys a pill from him, you know, and hands him a little bit of money. And then he writes down on a piece of paper, basically an IOU on a ledger that he has there. Mm. And he's just saying, this is my life. All these people owe me money. And he's like, this is only a third of the people who owe me money.
Oh,
and
man.
So, you know, he was always fronting people or only taking, you know, a certain amount with, you know, he was a nice guy. I mean, he was.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it's an interesting thing we could talk for probably another hour about, is when you're working undercover, how you do build relationships with the people you're working. And it's an interesting kind of phenomenon, really. You know, so you're doing some buys on behalf of DEA, FBI. You're helping them make their case, but presumably you're still working the ginseng angle, too. Did you start buying ginseng from him, or how did it work? What happened with the ginseng?
Yeah, I did. Ironically, you know, the DEA's case really took off. Johnny had given me a sample of some cocaine. You know, of course, they sent it to their lab, tested it's cocaine. Then I went back and I bought some cocaine from Johnny. And shortly thereafter, so that that was in February. And by September, they executed a search warrant on Johnny, his business.
While your case is still going on. Whoa, okay.
Exactly. Oof. So they execute a search warrant in September on Johnny's store, on his home, and a car lot that I believe he was affiliated with. And basically, they seized some pill bottles and a couple hundred opioid pills. Some drug ledgers that I had talked about, you know, where he writes down these IOUs, and some firearms.
Okay.
So after that point, that was in September of 2009, you know, Johnny had always had ginseng and he just wasn't selling. He's always waiting for the price to go up. So come November that year, you know, prices are going up a little bit and he wants, you know, some cash. So
right.
He calls me up and he wants to sell some ginseng. So he tells me that he's got some guys that are going down to Florida. Mind you, you know, 2 months later, there's just a search warrant executed on his business, you know, right. For the sale and distribution of drugs.
Right.
He's got people going down to Florida to pick up pills for him. So he's like, look, I'm going to send this guy over, meet with him, and he's going to bring some ginseng. And if you could pay him for it, that's great. So I do meet a guy in North Carolina, and he's with some other, you know, guys that are going down to Florida to pick up pills for Johnny. Gives me the ginseng. I buy it, give him the money, and, you know, those guys are on their way. So regarding our regulations, Johnny is an unlicensed dealer.
Right.
So he's buying ginseng illegally. So that ginseng is tainted that he purchases. In violation of Tennessee state law, the guys he gives it to on his behalf transports it to interstate commerce,
right,
and sells it. So, you know, that's your basic Lacey Act violation right there.
Yep. Yep. And presumably worth more than $300. So it's a felony, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Nice. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And so this kind of continues.
Yeah.
So later in November, you know, Johnny calls me up. He's got some more ginseng to sell. He wants to meet me. You know, that first meeting, you know, talking about officer safety, it was in the daylight. It was off an exit in a very populated area. Felt pretty good. The next night when Johnny's coming over, it's getting later at night, you know, and I'm in a parking lot and he's calling me, telling me when he's going to come. And, you know, I guess it's derogatory, but on doper time, it just never works out. You know, on the, you say 6 o'clock, it becomes 7 o'clock, then it becomes 8 o'clock. And,
right.
You know, we're almost there, Tom. We're almost there.
Right.
So, you know, they finally show up and they're in a van. They pull in, you know, Johnny knows my vehicle, and five people jump out. And I'm like, am I going to get robbed? You know what,
right.
What's happening here? And they'll have to go to the bathroom. So they all run out and Johnny comes over and I'm like, well, I guess that's not what's going to happen.
So, and you bring up a good point though, because we deal with this all the time. Like, you know, when anybody who does undercover work deals with this all the time, and it doesn't matter whether you have a cover team on you or not, you cannot predict who's going to show up to a meeting. And so, right. You know, like you said, they might be an hour or two late. And if they're starting to push it into darkness, that changes the safety issues. And then, yeah, like you said, you might be planning to meet with one guy, but you can't control who that person brings with them. And that is something that all officers who do undercover work have to deal with. And they have to accept that risk and be ready to like go with the flow and wing it. And make a decision whether you're going to stay or whether you're going to get out of there, right? But
that's
scary,
right.
Scary situation, yeah.
Tentative flexible agenda.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So you, go ahead. You're making these deals.
Johnny, you know, he jumps in the truck and he just immediately starts telling me about the DEA executing a search warrant on his place.
Awesome.
He's like, Tom, I had marijuana and cocaine, but they didn't find it.
Nice.
He's just happy as ever could be.
Nice.
And, you know, he's talking about the search warrant, what's going on, and he's got me in tears, Ed. He's just yucking it up, and he said, Tom, they had a drug dog, and damn it, that dog crapped right in the middle of my floor. And he was just like, I'm telling that agent, they got to clean this up. This is not right. Like, there's nothing going on in his life. I'm like, man, I'd be scared, you know. Like,
yeah.
They just executed a search warrant on me. Now I'm going down to Florida to get more pills.
And he's telling you that they missed the place where he had all the contraband hidden, right?
Exactly.
Unbelievable. That's actually maybe a good reason why they did the warrant in the middle of your investigation, because you got to hear from him what he thought of the whole search warrant. Interesting.
Sure.
Interesting.
And also enabled them to start looking at, airplane, records, manifests, who was on there, who's going down, who's coming back, where these prescriptions were, being filled. Their case really took off.
That's great. Awesome. And how much ginseng are you buying from him at this point?
I met with Johnny on five occasions, and I bought almost 36 pounds of ginseng. And I was paying anywhere between, at that time, $400 and $600 a pound.
Wow.
So we paid Johnny just over $18,000.
Okay. For ginseng. And then there was the drug stuff in between. And did you ever, so he's doing this illegally because he's not a licensed ginseng dealer. What about, did you get any evidence that he was buying from illegal collectors? So that the ginseng he was getting wasn't legal anyway.
Right. Certainly did. And it was just really a stroke of luck. But I guess as a saying around here goes, even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while. But ginseng, the formula is basically 300 ginseng roots equals 1 pound of ginseng when it dries out.
Okay.
So we purchased about 36 pounds of ginseng. And all the ginseng that we would buy, we actually went ahead and blacklighted it. Remember when Johnny talked about the ginseng in the park having dye on it?
Yeah, was that true? Was that real?
In fact, it is. A gentleman from the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, Jim Corbin, he dreamed up and invented this program where he created a dye that initially they would put it at the base of the ginseng root and spray some glue on it in this fluorescent dye would adhere to the plant. Eventually, he had it being absorbed up into the plant. Jim was a mastermind. He every year would do a, what he called a blitz into the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and he would get as many people as he could that was interested in going to the backcountry, and they would just locate ginseng, pull back the dirt and the duff, and they would apply this dye, spray it on, or have it come on the uproot. And so,
wow,
the ginseng actually glowed when you would put a light over it, a black light. And we did find a few pieces of ginseng that actually had fluorescent dye on it. And so Ryan took that to the park and they looked at it and they wrote up a nice professional opinion that, yes, in fact, this is our dye. Jim was so into it that he actually created different colors and different markers of dye. So in different areas, like in the Forest Service, they would use a different color.
Right.
And Jim, you know, I want to call Jim out because he was just a great associate of mine. He helped me so much. The North Carolina Wildlife Resources, or excuse me, the North Carolina Department of Ag and Consumer Services, their plant protection division, they're regulatory.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of the ginseng overseers in the state are regulatory. You know, and there's a big difference between a regulatory agency and a law enforcement agency.
Yes.
You know, so they're really not doing enforcement, and it's hard for them to get people to fall in line with the laws and regulations. You know, basically they just tell them, don't do this. Jim had a heart of gold and he would call me up all the time and never want anything in return. He would tell me, Tom, you need to look at this person. I would say, Jim, can you get me records? You know, so I could do a record investigation on things. And he was just a great asset to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's the way it's supposed to be. And I love hearing that because that's, it makes your job so much easier. And, you know, that's the way it's supposed to work. Public service, you know, we're supposed to cooperate. That's great.
Exactly.
So what was the, when you finally took this case down, what was the outcome? What happened to Johnny? How was he charged and what was the sentence?
Yeah. So, you know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finished up our buys in like, February of 2010.
Okay.
And so then, you know, all the paperwork begins to get people charged, work with the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, a couple of different agencies working together. Johnny was indicted in August of 2010.
Okay.
So a few months later, he was indicted. There were two superseding indictments on that. And he was eventually charged with 19 counts.
Wow.
Including 7 for felony Lacey Act counts, which we were pretty proud of, you know, and all the
absolutely
stuff going on to get some, you know, Lacey Act charges in there.
Of course. Absolutely.
Johnny, he went to trial in May of 2011. You know, the wheels of justice move slow, as
yep.
you know.
Yep.
So he had a 4-day trial and he was convicted, I believe, on all charges.
Wow. And what, yeah. what I'm going to ask you a little bit about that trial in a second. We're going to wrap up pretty soon, but what was the sentence on that?
Johnny was actually sentenced to 24 years for drug and felony Lacey Act violations.
Wow. That is an awesome sentence.
Yeah. It was basically a death sentence for Johnny. I mean, at the time when he was, convicted, he was 59, and he did pass away after serving 12 years.
Wow.
Also, two other gentlemen were convicted of felony Lacey Act that you remember I talked about meeting other people.
Yeah.
They were both charged and convicted and did a small sentence.
Nice.
For those two. So we got two. Ryan got two extra charges out of that.
Excellent. It's always good to wrap up as many people as you can in one case. What was Johnny's reaction when he found out? Because presumably you testified in the trial. What was his reaction when he found out that this guy he trusted so much had been an undercover Fish and Wildlife special agent?
Yeah, that's always a strange feeling.
It is.
You're on the stand and you look across and, you know, you have to identify the defendant. And he just kind of looked down and, you know, I think at that time he started to realize all the things that he told me. You know, of course, his attorney had all the reports and everything to read, you know, pre-trial. But, you know, it's hard from an agent's perspective when, you know, you're working these people and, you know, he's doing bad things. And I'm starting to feel about like, hey, you know, the money we're paying Johnny's helping to subsidize this drug trafficking thing, you know, and that started to weigh on me pretty heavy. But, you know, you kind of keep your eye on the prize, what's happening, and, you know, you're looking for the end goal. And, you know, if you could take out Johnny, that community is going to be a lot safer, a lot better for people in that community. So it was a good feeling, you know, actually also to look across the table and see Johnny there and to think that, you know, we all did a good job, all the agencies collectively together.
Absolutely. And as we've said many times on this podcast, you know, the law really has no impact if there aren't consequences, right?
Right.
And I always found it very strange to be sitting across a courtroom looking at people I had spent months or more years working undercover, and now the realization is setting in with them. I'm in a suit and tie, I'm clean shaven, and now I'm Special Agent Ed Newcomer. It's a kind of a surreal experience. But the other thing you mentioned is that I think all undercover, any officer, actually undercover or overt cases, casework, you always have this dilemma of when do you take the case down? And there's some point you reach where you've got enough evidence and you can't allow crime to continue anymore. And it's time to take the case down, right? And I think sometimes law enforcement officers, they can't like make the decision, right? And they like kind of let the case go too long or too short or whatever. It's a hard one. It's definitely hard.
It is. Yeah, there's definitely, you know, the right time to do that, you know. And it's out, you know, the Assistant United States Attorney that was involved in the case, you know, he was outstanding on that as well. Neil Smith, you know, he knew what he needed, and, you know, he called it when it should have been called.
Yeah. Good. Well, you know, I just think this case is fascinating, of course, because I worked most of my career on the West Coast. I never did any ginseng cases. So this has been really educational for me to hear from you to talk about the case. And I think it's also really interesting because we often talk about how wildlife trafficking overlaps with other, you know, wildlife and plant trafficking overlaps with other types of crimes. But this is a really interesting case that shows how, you know, a trafficker is a trafficker. And if they see another opportunity to make money illegally, whether it's drugs, guns, humans, they'll do it.
Sure.
The last thing before we sign off, which I think is kind of interesting, I'd love it for you to tell our listeners and viewers what happened to that grocery store outside the park shortly after this case.
Yeah. You know, sad and tragic, but there was an apartment down in the basement section of the park entrance grocery store that Johnny had rented out. And a guy actually shot and killed his girlfriend in that basement while, you know, at the end of this investigation. And then it, you know, eventually burned down. Nobody really knows how, but it just kind of caught on fire one day.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of apropos.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I had a case like that where about 3 months after my undercover case closed, a vacant house that was up on a hill overlooking one of the main bad guys' house mysteriously burned to the ground. And I knew from doing my case that the bad guy suspected that surveillance was being done from that house. Now, nobody knows why that house burned down, but the timing of it is very suspicious after a major criminal case comes to close, right? Yeah. Interesting. There's probably more work to do in that county. But listen, Tom, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. I know you were a reluctant guest and I twisted your arm and made you come on, and I really appreciate it. I think this is going to be a great episode. I think people are going to learn a lot. I certainly did. And I hope I can have you on to talk about other cases you've worked on over the years, but I'll twist your other arm later to get that done.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Ed, and I appreciate what you're doing, telling stories of, you know, state and federal wildlife agents.
Great. Thank you, Tom. It's great to see you again and hear your voice as well. And I hope you have a great rest of your week. And everybody out there listening, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.